Chapter 19. Like Mrs. Melrose, like all her tribe in fact, she was too much absorbed in her own affairs to give more than a passing thought to anyone else's. But she was delighted at the meeting with Susie, as her wandering kind always were when they ran across fellow wanderers, unless the meeting happened to interfere with choicer pleasures. Not to be alone was the urgent thing, and Ursula, who had been 48 hours alone in London, at once exacted from her friend a promise that they should spend the rest of the day together. But once the bargain struck, her mind turned again to her own affairs, and she poured out her confidences to Susie over a succession of dishes that manifested the head waiter's understanding of the case. Ursula's confidences were always the same, though they were usually about a different person. She demolished and rebuilt her sentimental life with the same frequency and impetuosity as that with which she changed her dressmakers, did over her drawing rooms, ordered new motors, altered the mounting of her jewels, and generally renewed the setting of her life. Susie knew in advance what the tale would be, but to listen to it over perfect coffee, an amber-scented cigarette at her lips, was pleasanter than consuming cold mutton alone in a moldy coffee room. The contrast was so soothing that she even began to take a languid interest in her friend's narrative. After luncheon they got into the motor together and began a systematic round of the West End shops. Furriers, jewelers, and dealers in old furniture. Nothing could be more unlike Violet Melrose's long hesitating sessions before the things she thought she wanted till the moment came to decide. Ursula pounced on silver foxes and old lacquer as promptly and decisively as on the objects of her surplus sentimentality. She knew at once what she wanted, and valued it more after it was hers. "And now I wonder if you couldn't help me choose a grand piano," she suggested, as the last antiquarian bowed them out. "A piano?" "Yes. For Ruin. I'm sending one down for Grace Fulmer. She's coming to stay. Did I tell you? I want people to hear her. I want her to get engagements in London. My dear, she's a genius." "A genius, Grace?" Susie gasped. "Thought it was Nat. Nat Fulmer?" Ursula laughed derisively. "H, of course you've been staying with that silly Violet. The poor thing is off her head about Nat. It's really pitiful. Of course he has talent. I saw that long before Violet had ever heard of him. Why, on the opening day of the American Artists Exhibition, last winter, I stopped short before his spring snowstorm, which nobody else had noticed till that moment, and said to the prince, who was with me, 'The man has talent. But genius, why, it's his wife who has genius. Have you never heard Grace play the violin? Poor Violet, as usual, is off on the wrong tack. I've given Fulmer my garden house to do, no doubt Violet told you, because I wanted to help him. But Grace is my discovery, and I'm determined to make her known, and to have everyone understand that she is the genius of the two. I've told her she simply must come to Ruin, and bring the best accompanist she can find. You know poor Naren is dreadfully bored by sport, though of course he goes out with the guns. And if one didn't, have a little art in the evening. Oh, Susie, do you mean to tell me you don't know how to choose a piano? I thought you were so fond of music." "I am fond of it, but without knowing anything about it in the way we're all of us fond of the worthwhile things in our stupid set," she added to herself, since it was obviously useless to impart such reflections to Ursula. "But are you sure Grace is coming?" she questioned aloud. "Quite sure. Why shouldn't she? I wired to her yesterday. I'm giving her $1,000 and all her expenses." It was not till they were having tea in a Piccadilly tea room that Mrs. Gillow began to manifest some interest in her companion's plans. The thought of losing Susie became suddenly intolerable to her. The prince, who did not see why he should be expected to linger in London out of season, was already at Ruin, and Ursula could not face the evening and the whole of the next day by herself. "But what are you doing in town, darling? I don't remember if I've asked you," she said, resting her firm elbows on the tea table, while she took a light from Susie's cigarette. Susie hesitated. As he had foreseen, that the time must soon come when she should have to give some account of herself. And why should she not begin by telling Ursula? But telling her what? Her silence appeared to strike Mrs. Gillow as a reproach, and she continued with compunction. Andy Nick? Nick's with you? How is he? I thought you and he still were in Venice with Ellie Vanderlyn. We were, for a few weeks. She steadied her voice. Tea was delightful. But now we're both on our own again for a while. Mrs. Gillow scrutinized her more searchingly. H, you're alone here, then? Quite alone? Yes. Nick's cruising with some friends in the Mediterranean. Ursula's shallow gaze deepened singularly. But, Susie darling, then if you're alone, and out of a job, just for the moment? Susie smiled. I'm not sure. Oh, but if you are, darling, and you would come to ruin. I know Fred asked you, didn't he? And he told me that both you and Nick had refused. He was awfully huffed that you're not coming, but I suppose that was because Nick had other plans. We couldn't have him now, because there's no room for another gun. But since he's not here, and you're free, why you know, dearest, don't you, how we'd love to have you. Fred would be too glad, too outrageously glad, but you don't much mind Fred's lovemaking, do you? And you'd be such a help to me, if that's any argument. With that big house full of men, and people flocking over every night to dine, and Fred caring only for sport, and Naren simply loathing it and ridiculing it, and not a minute to myself to try to keep him in a good humor. Susie darling, don't say no, but let me telephone at once for a place in the train tomorrow night. Susie leaned back, letting the ash lengthen on her cigarette. How familiar, how hatefully familiar, was that old appeal. Ursula felt the pressing need of someone to flirt with Fred for a few weeks. And here was the very person she needed. Susie shivered at the thought. As he had never really meant to go to ruin. As he had simply used the moor as a pretext, when Violet Melrose had gently put her out of doors. Rather than do what Ursula asked, she would borrow a few £100 of Strefford, as he had suggested, and then look about for some temporary occupation until she became Lady Altringham? Well, perhaps. At any rate, she was not going back to slave for Ursula. She shook her head with a faint smile. I'm so sorry, Ursula. Of course I want awfully, to oblige you, Mrs. Gillow's gaze grew reproachful. Should have supposed you would, she murmured. Susie, meeting her eyes, looked into them down a long vista of favors bestowed, and perceived that Ursula was not the woman to forget on which side the obligation lay between them. Susie hesitated. She remembered the weeks of ecstasy as he had owed to the Gillow's wedding check, and it hurt her to appear ungrateful. If I could, Ursula. But really, I'm not free at the moment. She paused, and then took an abrupt decision. The fact is, I'm waiting here to see Strefford. Strefford Lord Altringham? Ursula stared. Yes, I remember. You and he used to be great friends, didn't you? Her roving attention deepened. But if Susie were waiting to see Lord Altringham, one of the richest men in England. Suddenly Ursula opened her gold mesh bag, and snatched a miniature diary from it. But wait a moment, yes, it is next week. I knew it was next week he's coming to ruin. But, you darling, that makes everything all right. You'll send him a wire at once, and come with me tomorrow, and meet him there instead of in this nasty sloppy desert. Susie, if you knew how hard life is for me in Scotland between the prince and Fred, you couldn't possibly say no. Susie still wavered. But, after all, if Strefford were really bound for ruin, why not see him there, agreeably and at leisure, instead of spending a dreary day with him in roaming the wet London streets, or screaming at him through the rattle of a restaurant orchestra? She knew he would not be likely to postpone his visit to ruin in order to linger in London with her. Such concessions had never been his way, and were less than ever likely to be, now that he could do so thoroughly and completely as he pleased. For the first time she fully understood how different his destiny had become. Now of course all his days and hours were mapped out in advance. Invitations assailed him, opportunities pressed on him, he had only to choose. Dot, and the women. She had never before thought of the women. All the girls in England would be wanting to marry him, not to mention her own enterprising compatriots. And there were the married women, who were even more to be feared. Streff might, for the time, escape marriage, though she could guess the power of persuasion, family pressure, all the converging traditional influences he had so often ridiculed, yet, as she knew, had never completely thrown off. Dot, yes, those quiet invisible women at Altrincham, his uncle's widow, his mother, the spinster sisters, it was not impossible that, with tact and patience, and the stupidest women could be tactful and patient on such occasions, they might eventually persuade him that it was his duty, they might put just the right young loveliness in his way. Dot, but meanwhile, now, at once, there were the married women. Ah, they wouldn't wait, they were doubtless laying their traps already. Susie shivered at the thought. She knew too much about the way the trick was done, had followed, too often, all the sinuosities of such approaches. Not that they were very sinuous nowadays. More often there was just a swoop, and a pounce when the time came, but she knew all the arts and the wiles that led up to it. She knew them, oh, how she knew them though with Streff. Thank heaven, as he had never been called upon to exercise them. His love was there for the asking. Would she not be a fool to refuse it? Perhaps, though on that point her mind still wavered. But at any rate she saw that, decidedly, it would be better to yield to Ursula's pressure, better to meet him at Rouen, in a congenial setting, where she would have time to get her bearings, observe what dangers threatened him, and make up her mind whether, after all, it was to be her mission to save him from the other women. Well, if you like, then, Ursula. Dot dot dot. Oh, you angel, you. I'm so glad. We'll go to the nearest post office, and send off the wire ourselves. As they got into the motor, Mrs. Gillow seized Susie's arm with a pleading pressure. Andy, you will let Fred make love to you a little, won't you, darling? XVIII, but I can't think, said Ellie Vanderlyn earnestly, why you don't announce your engagement before waiting for your divorce. People are beginning to do it, I assure you it's so much safer. Mrs. Vanderlyn, on the way back from St. Moritz to England, had paused in Paris to renew the depleted wardrobe which, only 2 months earlier, had filled so many trunks to bursting. Other ladies, flocking there from all points of the globe for the same purpose, disputed with her the Louis XVI suites of the Nouveau Luxe, the pink-candled tables in the restaurant, the hours for trying on at the dressmakers. And just because they were so many, and all feverishly fighting to get the same things at the same time, they were all excited, happy and at ease. It was the most momentous period of the year, the height of the dressmaker's season. Mrs. Vanderlyn had run across Susie Lansing at one of the Rue de la Paix openings, where rows of ladies wan with heat and emotion sat for hours in rapt attention, while spectral apparitions in incredible raiment tottered endlessly past them on aching feet. Distracted from the regal splendors of a chinchilla cloak by the sense that another lady was also examining it, Mrs. Vanderlyn turned in surprise at sight of Susie, whose head was critically bent above the fur. Susie, I'd no idea you were here. I saw in the papers that you were with the Gillows. The customary embraces followed. Then Mrs. Vanderlyn, her eyes pursuing the matchless cloak as it disappeared down a vista of receding mannequins, interrogated sharply. Are you shopping for Ursula? If you mean to order that cloak for her, I'd rather know. Susie smiled, and paused a moment before answering. During the pause she took in all the exquisite details of Ellie Vanderlyn's perpetually youthful person, from the plumed crown of her head to the perfect arch of her patent leather shoes. At last she said quietly, "Oh, today I'm shopping for myself."
"Yourself? Yourself?"
Mrs. Vanderlyn echoed with a stare of incredulity.
"Yes, just for a change," Susie serenely acknowledged.
"But the cloak, I meant the chinchilla cloak. Dot dot dot, the one with the ermine lining. Dot dot dot."
"Yes, it is awfully good, isn't it? But I mean to look elsewhere before I decide."
Ah, how often as he had heard her friends use that phrase, and how amusing it was, now, to see Ellie's amazement as she heard it tossed off in her own tone of contemptuous satiety. Susie was becoming more and more dependent on such diversions. Without them, her days, crowded as they were, would nevertheless have dragged by heavily. But it still amused her to go to the big dressmakers, watch the mannequins sweep by, and be seen by her friends superciliously examining all the most expensive dresses in the procession. She knew the rumor was abroad, that she and Nick were to be divorced, and that Lord Altringham was evident to her. She neither confirmed, nor denied the report. She just let herself be luxuriously carried forward on its easy tide. But although it was now 3 months since Nick had left the Palazzo Vanderlyn, he had not yet written to him nor he to her. Meanwhile, in spite of all that she packed into them, the days, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.